Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon at this time so that you can call in if you wish, listening to the live broadcast for an hour each afternoon. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, that's what we're interested in talking with you about. You can also call in if you disagree with the host on something and want to balance comment. The number to call is 844-484-5737. Now, all the lines are full at the moment, but lines will be opening up throughout the program. So if you have this number handy and call it randomly, you may very well find a line has opened up. This happens many times during the hour. The number again is 844-484-5737. And I also want to say that we have a Zoom meeting tonight, which anyone anywhere can join. It's at 7 o'clock Pacific time. So if you're in a different time zone, obviously you have to make the calculations. 7 o'clock Pacific time tonight. It's a Q&A and, so about the Bible. And if you'd like to join us, you can do so. Just go to thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, our website. Click on the tab that says Announcements. And then scroll down to today's date, and you will find the login information if you want to join us on Zoom tonight. You can do it from anywhere in the world. Now, if you live in Southern California or you're going to be in Southern California this weekend, we have two meetings this Saturday that we only have once a month. We have a morning Bible study for men. We're in the book of 1 Thessalonians. And we have an evening meeting for everybody. It's a Q&A meeting. Both are in Temecula. And if you're interested in those, that's 8 o'clock in the morning for the men's Bible studies this Saturday. And I believe it's 7 o'clock in the evening for the Q&A meeting. Those meeting times and place are located also at our website, thenarrowpath.com. You can find out how to join us in person there. That's this Saturday morning and night. And then, of course, tonight, the Zoom meeting. All right, let's talk to Joe from Oceanside, California. Joe, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Greg, love your program. Thanks for your opinions and everything. I had a question for you regarding, this came across my mind a ways back. You know how we're told that we're going to be caught up? And I know I looked at a little word that says harpazo, and I thought, could that possibly mean that when we die, I'm thinking, you know, my rapture and all that kind of good stuff, but if we die, and because our absent from the body, present with the Lord, our bodies kind of go with the Lord, could that be the rapture sort of? I wonder if that word kind of applies to that or, you know, does that?
Well, it is true that when we die, if we are believers, we do go to be with the Lord, but our bodies don't. Our bodies don't go to the Lord. You can prove that to yourself simply by going to the grave of any Christian and looking to see if their body is there. It is. Their bodies have not left yet, but they will. Jesus said the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. So the physical bodies will be resurrected at the second coming of Christ. The spirit leaves the body at death. And if you're a believer, that's your spirit, I think, goes to be with the Lord in heaven immediately at death. But the body remains in the grave until the resurrection and the rapture. And that's what Paul's talking about when he uses the word harpazo in 1 Thessalonians 4. Verse 16 and 17, where he says the dead in Christ will rise first, and then those who are alive and remain will be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. Now, obviously, he makes a distinction. There are people who have died, and there's people who have not died. And the ones who have died will rise from the dead. The ones who have not died will be caught up. So he obviously is not talking about something that happens at the time that you die. He's talking about something that happens to people who have not died. And he says in the passage, as you read the verses just before that, that this happens at the coming of the Lord. He says that those of us who are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord will not precede those who have died, but they will be raised first, then we who are alive and remain will be caught up to meet them. So this is not talking about what happens at the point of death. This is what happens, as it says, at the coming of the Lord. And it's the catching up of the saints, or the rapture, is in contrast to the raising of the dead, which happens just prior to it.
Perfect. Right on. I appreciate your clarification on that. That's been bugging me for a long time. Anyway, thanks again for your stuff, and I don't want to keep any hold you back, but thank you, bro.
Okay, Joe. Thanks for your call. God bless you. Mary, I'm sorry, excuse me, this is not Mary. This is Boyd from Marysville, Washington. Hi, Boyd. Welcome. Boyd, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm sorry.
Yes.
I have two questions, but the first one will be very short. So the first one is in regard to a caller a couple of days ago and the subject of the ASB Bible. You said it was hard to find, so I did some looking and found some on Amazon and eBay, but I wanted to make sure about this. I found the 1952 Revised Standard Version, which was revised in 1901. So is that the same as the ASB that you were talking about? And then the second?
The Revised Standard Version, is that what you said? The Revised Standard
Yes.
Version is not an American Standard Bible. It's there was a Bible, I think it was in the late 1800s, called the Revised Version. And then in, what did you say, 1952, I guess it was, they came out with the Revised Standard Version. It was basically an upgrade of that. Now, the American Standard Version was a different one. And the New American Standard, which came out in 1971, was an update of that. So the one that's called the ASV, I guess it's called the ASV, the American Standard Version, is the one the caller was asking about.
Okay. And the second question is from Genesis 28:6-9. There's a discrepancy between the writings of Josephus and our Bibles about when Esau married Halah. And the reason why he married her is also different. What source would Josephus have been using to come up with his account of the story?
You're talking about Esau's wives?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know where Josephus would have gotten his information. I have not looked this up in the Septuagint. It is possible that the Septuagint reads differently. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek that was made almost 300 years before Christ. So it was around, it was actually, the Septuagint was actually the version of the Old Testament that was used in the time of Jesus widely, and Josephus probably was using it too. So I don't know. I have the Septuagint on my shelf not far from me, but I haven't looked this up to see if that's, if it differs from the Hebrew. Sometimes the Septuagint does. And when the Septuagint differs from the Hebrew, we have to ask ourselves, did the Septuagint translators make a mistake? Or did they translate from earlier Hebrew manuscripts than the ones that our Bibles are translated from? Because our Bibles were translated from the Masoretic text, which dates from about 1000 A.D. Now, that doesn't mean that the material dates from 1000 A.D. That's just the manuscripts that we have are no older than that. There were much older manuscripts. And then they found the in the 40s, they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, which also had an older version of the Old Testament Hebrew text. And it's very, very close to the Masoretic text. But it's possible and probable, in fact, that when the Septuagint was translated almost 300 years before Christ, that they had even earlier Hebrew texts. And so it's possible, and I'm not saying that the Septuagint is what Josephus followed, but he might have because it was in wide usage in his day. It's possible that the Septuagint, if it differs, is actually based upon older Hebrew texts that aren't available anymore and that our Bibles did not use. So I honestly don't know which, you know, the way it reads in our Bible, which is taken from the Masoretic text, or if it reads differently in some other version like the Septuagint. I would have to check that out. I don't have time to do that right now, but it's possible. Now, if not, I don't know where Josephus got his material. Josephus, in the Antiquities of the Jews, when he was giving the Old Testament history, he had a lot of details in his history that are not found in our Bibles, and I don't know where he got them. They must have been traditional, or obviously he had other works available that were outside the Bible that we don't have now. So I can't tell you why there would be a difference at this particular point in terms of the wives of Esau. But those are some possible suggestions. He might have had some other sources besides the Bible, in which case I would trust the Bible more. Or he might have had older version of the Bible than we have. And sometimes there are some slight differences between the older manuscripts and the newer ones.
The difference that I'm finding is that in our Bibles, it attributes Esau to going and getting a wife from non-Canaanite background because Jacob has seen greater favor with Isaac and Rebekah by going and doing their bidding and going to Laban and getting a wife there.
Right.
But in Josephus's, it says that when it gets to that portion about Jacob going to Laban, it says that Esau was already married to Mahalalath. So it changes the complete meaning of why Esau was getting married.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure where Josephus got that information. Of course, Esau had already married some women back in chapter 26 of Genesis and verse 34.
Yeah, two wives.
Yeah, he had married Judith and Basemath, and then he took these other wives in chapter 27. But yeah, I don't know where Josephus got that information.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you for your call. All right, let's talk to Peter from London, England. Peter, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Steve. I've been reading Job, and I think one thing I noticed a lot about the Bible is, and you've mentioned this a lot, is written in Hebrew poetry. And I'm just wondering, is it a case that even with some of the prophets, did that Job's friends, for example, did they speak poetically to Job, or was that just how, when, as the Bible was written, the message was conveyed through poetry, or did God actually speak poetically to the prophets?
Well, the case of Job's friends would be a little different than the case of the prophets, because the prophets were speaking oracles from God, whereas Job's friends were just speaking their own opinions. But the question is, why are their speeches in Job written in poetry? And there are two possibilities, and you actually, I think, suggested both of them. One is that they actually did speak that way. The other is that their speeches were not immediately written down in their own words, or even if they were, when the book of Job was written as a poetry book, their words were recast in poetry. A little bit like how Shakespeare, you know, when he writes about the history of certain kings and so forth, Julius Caesar, let's say, you know, he has put all the speeches are in poetry because William Shakespeare wrote poetic plays. Of course, he's not taking the actual words that were spoken, though he is following, I suppose, the general theme of history. Now, Shakespeare's not writing the Bible, of course. The book of Job, we don't know who wrote the book of Job because its author is not given to us, but whoever it was obviously a poet and wrote the speeches, his friend's speeches, Job's speeches, and even God's speeches in poetry. So it's possible that the record of what these men actually said was available, but it was maybe not spoken in poetry, but somebody writing a literary production, specifically a poetry book, cast their words into poetic form. That's a possibility. Now, there's also the possibility that these men did speak in poetry on these occasions. Now, the reason I say that is because Job and his friends were philosophers, and they were wise men of the time. And, you know, there's a certain way that people speak when they're trying to be sound sophisticated. And these men did not speak for 7 days. When Job was known to be afflicted, they came to him, and they sat silently for 7 days. And then they began to speak, or Job actually began to speak, then they responded. It's possible that they were framing their arguments during those 7 days. They might not maybe verbatim, but they may have been kind of putting together what they planned to say. Now, since Hebrew poetry is primarily made up of saying the same thing twice, different ways, a person in that culture, especially a highly intelligent philosophical person, might, when he chooses, speak that way. I mean, he can make his points and then for emphasis repeat it another way. I mean, if somebody really wanted to do that, I suppose probably anyone could do that. We're not used to that kind of speaking, but in the Middle East, that's how poetry was. So it may be that they actually did frame them. Now, and we don't know how much time elapsed between, for example, the time that Job stopped speaking and the next person began speaking. It's possible that they actually, in their minds, composed their speeches before delivering them. We don't know. I mean, that would be one theory. That would be one possibility, that the speeches are in poetry because that's how they were spoken. But it's also, I think more scholars would think that the men didn't speak in poetry, but that the poetic form of the speeches is the artistry of the author who wrote it at a later time.
And thanks for that, Steve. And my last question. So I was trying to explain to a friend of mine about the role of the devil or Satan, because my friend believes in the, I guess, maybe the most popular view that the devil used to be an angel. And I don't believe that. And in Job chapter 1, where it says the sons of God presented themselves to God and Satan was among them, is it blasphemous to say that? I mean, would you say that God uses the devil for his purposes in order to test us? Or is that sort of, I guess, stretching it too far?
No, I think that's exactly what the Bible teaches, that God exploits the devil just like God can exploit anything else in his creation. He created the devil, and the devil is subject to him. So if God wanted Job to be tested, and the devil wanted to afflict Job and ask for permission, then God could say, okay, you can do it up to this point, but no further. And then, you know, the testing of Job, which is obviously something God wanted to take place, took place, and the devil was the instrument. Though the devil was not friendly toward God, the devil, or toward Job, the devil was actually seeking to ruin Job. But God, knowing that Job would pass such tests, wanted this test to be made and allowed it. And likewise, when Judas Iscariot was filled with the devil and went and betrayed Jesus, and we know that in the garden when Jesus was arrested, Jesus said to the people who arrested him, "This is your hour and the power of darkness." He's admitting that the devil was now getting his opportunity. Now, there were many times in Jesus' life earlier, the Bible says, that people took up stones to stone him, but he just passed through their midst and they didn't harm him. Or other time, once they tried to throw him off a cliff and he just passed through their midst. I mean, and it, often the Bible says, because it was not yet his hour. Now, what this is saying is that God had determined when Jesus would die and when he would not. And those who wanted to kill him simply couldn't do it until it was his hour. And then, of course, we read that Jesus, when he was praying in the garden, says, "Now the hour has come." And when the enemy came to arrest him, he surrendered to them because his Father instructed him to. And when in the Acts of the Apostles, in Acts chapter 2, when Peter is talking about that incident, he says that the Jews, that Jesus was delivered. Let me give you the exact words of Peter here in Acts chapter 2. He says in verse 23, "Him being delivered by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken by lawless hands and crucified and put to death." Now it says that Jesus was delivered to their hands by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God in Acts 2:23. So God delivered Jesus over to them, meaning he let them take him and crucify him, which was the devil's plot, which God had not allowed to happen previously, though there had been human attempts. So we can see that God is in control of all this, and certainly God wanted Jesus to die and rise again and save the world. So in a sense, he was using the devil, exploiting the devil's ignorance. And I think that that's what the devil's for. I think if God had no purpose for the devil wouldn't be around anymore. God has no reason to have to tolerate him. God doesn't have to tolerate anything. In fact, if he doesn't have to tolerate people. God could fold up the universe and, like the chessboard, and say, "Okay, game over. and everyone would be gone if he wanted to. But everything he allows is something that he has a purpose for allowing. And since he allows the devil to exist, he certainly has a purpose for the devil. And the purpose of the devil is to test us and to do things that the devil himself intends for evil, but which God means for good.
Yeah, it's not a very popular view, but that was my train of thought. But thank you, Steve, for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay, Peter. God bless you. Thanks for your call. All right. We're going to talk next to Theo from Tampa, Florida. Hey, Theo. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. I was reading the story of Esau and Jacob once again, and I was wondering why the things Jacob did to get Esau's birthright and blessing, why were they binding?
Well, they swore with an oath. They were when Esau came in hungry and Jacob had food, and Esau said, "Give me some of that food." And Jacob said, "Well, I will if you give me your birthright." And Esau said, "Well, I'm starving to death. What good does my birthright do me if I starve to death?" So Jacob said, "Swear to me." And so they took an oath. Now, that's how business was transacted officially in ancient times. They didn't sign contracts. They took an oath. And so it was a binding oath. So now the birthright now belonged to Jacob by Esau's having, handed it over to him with an oath and said, "It's yours now." Now, as far as the blessing that came with the birthright, that was many years later when Jacob deceived Isaac about that. And even though Jacob had received the birthright by Esau's oath, Esau still wanted to get the special blessing, the patriarchal blessing from his father, which actually he had no entitlement to because it went with the birthright, but he still wanted it. And so there was that whole conniving there with Rebekah and Jacob to fool Isaac and get him to bless Jacob unwittingly and all that. That was still binding too. In fact, Isaac himself said it was when after he had realized that he'd accidentally blessed Jacob, and Esau, whom he had really wanted to bless, came along and said, "Wait, it's time to bless me." He says, "Well, I just blessed somebody. It must have been your brother." And Esau said, "Well, give something to me then. Can't you undo it?" And Isaac said, "Well, no, he's going to be blessed. I blessed him. He's going to be blessed. It's final." So, I mean, words were official.
Doesn't that seem to make God inflexible? I mean, if you're saying a name and it seems like God can't tell who you intend to bless, or I guess it just seems very wooden if something you said in by mistake or
Isaac didn't mention the name. Thought he was speaking to Esau and said, "You're going to rule over your brother and you're going to have, all these blessings above your brother." But he was speaking to Jacob, not knowing it. And so, I mean, his words were taken. Now, of course, God wasn't in favor of Esau getting the blessing. That's the point. I mean, what happened there was done through intrigue and through deception on the part of Rebekah and Jacob and so forth. But then Esau was being deceptive too, and so was Isaac, because Esau had no right to that. He was trying to secretly, behind Jacob's back, get the blessing that really belonged to Jacob. So everybody in that, and Isaac knew that too. Isaac knew the birthright had been sold. So it's like everyone in the family was wrong. I mean, everyone just was involved in a deception of some kind. And through it all, things got manipulated by providence, so that the blessing came on Jacob.
Okay, and I guess even God had predicted at their birth that Jacob would rule, right?
That's right. When they were in the womb, the two twins were in the womb, and God told Rebekah, "The older shall serve the younger." That means Esau would serve Jacob, and that's exactly what the patriarchal blessing was determining.
Okay, that clarifies things for me. Right. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, great talking to you. Thanks for joining us today. All right, we have a break coming up, and rather than take another call right now, we have another half hour coming up. At this point in the program, though, I just take the time to make some announcements again. If you are interested in joining us tonight for a face-to-face on Zoom, question and answer period. It's a lot like this radio show, only it's face-to-face on Zoom. Now, of course, face-to-face really should mean in person, but we've learned that there are other ways to be face-to-face in the last few years. And you can join us tonight at 7 o'clock Pacific time if you want to. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and there you can go to announcements and see how to log on to our Zoom meeting tonight and be a part of it yourself with us. And we're just going to have a somewhat longer period of time of question and answer than we have here on the air. Now, we have a whole hour here on each afternoon, and we're at the half-hour point now, so don't go away. We have another half hour. But I do like to make sure our listeners know that we don't have any commercial breaks. We don't sell products. We don't have sponsors. We don't have underwriters. But we spend about very close to $100,000 a month buying radio time so that you can listen to us free. That $100,000 a month comes from listeners who, like yourself, just say, well, I'd like to be able to keep listening to this program. And so they just send us unsolicited gifts. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. It's also possible to donate from the website. Again, that's thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you disagree with the host and want to say why, we'll be glad to talk to you. The number is 844-484-5737. Now, at the beginning of the show, a half hour ago, I had to say, well, we don't have any lines open. They're all full. That's not true now. We have two lines open right now. If you'd like to call, you could may be able to get in. The number is 844-484-5737. And our next caller today is Taylor in Indiana. Taylor, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. So I was calling in regards to Romans 9, namely that little section there, which I think is the most important. And I really want to hone in on like the specific words in order to make sense. I think I have the gist of what's going on. I think when we get down to verse 30, you know, he's still talking about, I think he's summarizing this. It's still a faith versus works type of idea. But so like mainly verses 7-9, where he says, nor are they all children because they are the seed of Abraham, but in Isaac, your seed shall be called. That is, those who are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God, but the children of the promise are. So I'm just having trouble breaking down those couple of verses there as to what he's saying. I guess, are the children of the seed, is that synonymous with the children of God? Because
Let me just draw back, get the bigger picture. Romans 9, 10, and 11. Are Paul's discussion about how the promises of God are fulfilled to Israel. And he begins by grieving that the majority of the Jewish people, his brethren, are not believers, and that although there are promises made to them, they have not cashed in on them. They have not benefited from them because they have not received Christ, and these promises are fulfilled in Christ. But he says in verse 6, but it's not that the word of God has taken no effect. Now, what he means by that is, God, in his word, in the Old Testament, had promised that the Messiah would come and would save Israel. But here, Jesus has come, and most of the people of Israel are not saved. And he says, well, what, did the promise not come true? No, he said, it's not that. It's not that the word of God has not taken effect. It's that not all are Israel who are of Israel. Now, what he's saying there is, God's promises to Israel have not failed to come true. They haven't fallen to the ground. They haven't taken no effect. They have, in fact, been fulfilled, but they've been fulfilled to Israel. But not everybody who is of Israel is Israel. That is, the promises did not apply to everybody born of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, that would have to include Judas Iscariot, Caiaphas, you know, every rebellious Jew who worshiped Moloch, Manasseh, you know, who burned his children.
Sorry, when you say the promises don't apply, is he speaking then? Is that promise of salvation? Is that?
Well, not specifically, though salvation is a part of it. God made promises to Abraham that had very little to do with Abraham's own salvation. He said that he would make him a great nation, and that he and his seed would be a blessing to all the families of the earth. Now, that blessing does include salvation. As Paul goes into in Galatians chapter 3, he talks about the promise of Abraham is justification by faith and receiving the Spirit of God through faith. These are the promises that God made to Abraham. But the promise was not that Abraham would, receive the Spirit, but that through his offspring, all the nations would. Now, the offspring, Paul says in another passage in Galatians 3:16, the offspring or the seed of Abraham is Jesus. So through the seed of Abraham, that is through Jesus, all the families of the earth are blessed, namely through the gospel. But in Romans, Paul is talking about the promise of being God's people. Yeah, that involves salvation. But he's not thinking of salvation per se in the sense that we do. He's not talking about people going to heaven per se, though the same people he's talking about will be in heaven. But he's not talking about heaven. He's talking about being God's people. The most important thing to Israel in the Old Testament was not that they'd go to heaven. In fact, they knew nothing about that. The Old Testament makes no promises of anyone going to heaven. So the Jews didn't have that as part of their mental furniture. Their privilege was to be the people of God here on earth, among the nations, a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. This is their earthly role. The great privilege of Israel had nothing to do with heaven. It had to do with being God's people. Now, what Paul is saying is, the Messiah has come, and those people who saw themselves as God's people didn't participate with the Messiah. And yet the Old Testament said the Messiah would come to God's people and would turn them away from their sins and, yes, would save them. And he says, but these promises were not to every Jew, because not everyone who is of Israel is Israel. He's saying there's a remnant within Israel that these applied to. Now, by the way, just jumping ahead for a second, he quotes Isaiah in Romans 9:27, where Isaiah said, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, the remnant will be saved. Or in our Hebrew Bibles in Isaiah 10, it says the remnant shall return. But the point is, he's saying, yeah, there's a lot of Jewish people out there. The children of Israel are as numerous as the sand of the seashore, but only a remnant of them are promised salvation. And that's what Paul's saying in verse 6. Not all are Israel who are of Israel. Every Jew is of Israel, but not all are the Israel that God has chosen to be his people. And he goes on, and these are the verses you asked about. He says, nor are they all children, this is verse 7, because they are all the seed of Abraham. That is, now, just because they've all descended from Abraham doesn't make them all God's people. He says, but, and he quotes this from Genesis, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Now, why did he quote that? That's a quotation from Genesis 21:12. Why did he quote God saying to Abraham, in Isaac your seed shall be called? Well, because Abraham had other children too. Ishmael was Abraham's son. And then Isaac. And then there were six more born to Abraham by another wife named Keturah. And so there were like eight sons of Abraham. And God had promised through Abraham's seed the world would be blessed, but not through all of them, only through Isaac. That is, what Paul is saying is, God singled out one of Abraham's many sons and said, this is the one through whom all the nations are going to be blessed. This is the one that I'm going to fulfill my promises through. And so he says, it's not all those who are descended from Abraham, because God said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. And by that he means there were seven other sons of Abraham that were not included in this promise. So being descended from Abraham doesn't make you a child of the promise just because you're a child of the flesh. He says those who are the children of the flesh, meaning those who are physically descended from Abraham, these are not the children of God. This is verse 8. but the children of the promise are counted as the seed. So Isaac was a child of the promise. He's the child of Abraham through whom the promises would be fulfilled. The others were not. They were children of Abraham according to the flesh. That is, they were physically his children. But they weren't the promised ones. Now, this what he's arguing here, he has said in verse 6, not everyone who is of Israel is the chosen Israel, the people of God. For example, Abraham had many sons, and promises were made to him and his seed, but only one of the seed was relevant. The others were not. Then he said in verse 9, for this is the word of promise, at this time I will come and Sarah shall have a son. That's a promise. So Isaac was born because of a promise, not just from fleshly means. Now verse 10, he says, and not only this, but when Rebekah had conceived by one man, even our father Isaac. So he's moved another generation forward. He said, okay, Abraham had a bunch of sons, but only Isaac was the chosen one. Now Isaac and Rebekah, they had two sons. Now only one of them is going to be chosen, and the other's not. It says, for the children not yet being born, this is Jacob and Esau in the womb of Rebekah, nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him who calls, it was said to her, this is what God spoke to her when the two twins were duking it out in her womb. Back in Genesis 25:23, God said, the older shall serve the younger, meaning Esau would be the servant to Jacob, meaning that Jacob would be the one who has the birthright, not Esau. Now, what Paul has been arguing here is that only some within the nation of Israel are really the promised ones, just like only some of Abraham's children, only one of Abraham's children was, and only one of Isaac's children was. What he's arguing is...
When you're saying, though, the promised ones, are you saying the promised one, is that just in regard to, like, the service of bringing about the lineage, or is salvation also in mind there? Because that's where it seems like verse 6 is talking about salvation, but then it seems like after that maybe you're shifting to more of a service. And I'm just trying to...
Well, the people who are the people of God are the ones who also have salvation, okay? But the question that Paul's arguing here is not who has salvation, but who are the people of God? You know, are all of Abraham's children the people of God? No, only those who came through Isaac. Are all of Isaac's children the people of God? No, only those who came through Jacob. In other words, in every generation, there were people who were descended from Abraham and even from Isaac who were not the people of God, but some were. There's a remnant in the family that are. Now, when he said that the older shall serve the younger, when he said that Esau would serve Jacob, there's no suggestion here about salvation, because serving one person serving another one has nothing to do with being in heaven or hell. It's not talking about the afterlife. It's talking about status in their earthly lives, that Jacob would have the status of the chosen one. What chosen for what? Chosen to bring the Messiah into the world. So was Jacob also saved? Well, I think he was. Yeah, the Hebrews chapter 11 says that he had faith, and that's what saves a person. But there were many of the descendants of Jacob, even ones through whom Jesus came, like King Manasseh and so forth, wicked, who were not saved, but they were in the lineage of the Messiah. In other words, the purpose of Israel was to bring the Messiah into the world. But those who did bring the Messiah in the world weren't all people who went to heaven when they died. Some were good, some were bad. It's the nation. It's the family line that brings the Messiah. And so what Paul's saying is the people of God are not simply defined by physical ancestry to Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob even. They're chosen by promise. And Jacob was given a promise. Esau was not. And then he quotes Malachi. In verse 13, as it is written, Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated. Now, what he's talking about is God choosing parts of the family line. Which branch of the family line is going to be, the ones through whom the promise is fulfilled? It was not Esau, it was Jacob. It was not Ishmael, it was Isaac. And frankly, among Jacob's sons, it was not any of the 11 except Judah. It was Judah, one of the 12 sons. And then even of Judah's descendants, not all of them, but David. David, who is a descendant of Judah, was the one who was chosen through whom the Messiah would come, and so forth. So what Paul is saying is it's not simply having the right parentage that makes you people of God. Because in every generation, there are people who had good parentage. Descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's the right parentage. But they weren't people of God because they were not
people of God. You just, is that me referring to the believers, the faithful remnant?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That helps then. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time. Sorry for taking so much of it up.
Okay, Taylor. Thanks for calling. Good talking to you. Okay, our next caller is Sam from Dallas, Texas. Sam, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have a question regarding Hebrew 11:32, where there's a list of heroes of faith is mentioned, and one name is, I believe, is Jephthah. That's how you pronounce.
Yes, that's correct.
My question is, I know I've been reading about it, and there's a lot of criticism is like that the vows he made it regarding wins the battle against the Ammonites, then whatever comes out from his house, the first person, he will sacrifice, and his daughter came, and he then fulfilled. And there are some critiques. This is like that was a very foolish vow that he practiced because God does not endorse to sacrifice any other human being, and especially a child.
Right.
So my question is, what is your understanding? Because he is listed as the heroes of faith. So if you could elaborate, I would appreciate that, and I'll take the answer off here.
Okay. Well, every person that's listed as a hero of faith did some things wrong. The reason they're in the list of faithful people is because they had faith. And, I mean, think of the people who are listed. You've got Samson is just before Jephthah. You've got Samson in there, and he was a carnal man who did a whole lot of things wrong. Jephthah made a mistake in making a foolish vow. David made some terrible, sinful mistakes, obviously, in sleeping with Bathsheba and killing her husband. Frankly, just about everyone in the list, as you go back to the Old Testament, you can see in their history they did some things that were foolish or wrong. So this is not a list of people who have been perfect people. This is a list of people who are justified by faith, which is just like you and me. We are justified by faith in Christ. But we have, you know, if you want to comb through our family histories or our personal histories, I should say, you'll find that we did some things that we'd rather not mention in the past. We've done things that we'd rather have forgotten. There are things that were mistakes, sins, foolish things that we've all done. But that does not prevent us from being justified by faith. And the same thing is true of everybody, frankly, in this list. Probably the only exception would be Joseph. We don't have any record of Joseph doing anything wrong, but virtually everyone else, Moses, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Samson, Jephthah, David, I mean, there's mistakes they've made. Now, the thing is that Jephthah is probably best remembered for his mistake. And that would be probably true of Samson, too. Samson is best remembered for his mistakes. He was a pretty carnal man, did a lot of things wrong, violated his vows and so forth. But it's interesting that they are named anyway, because the writer of Hebrews apparently is telling us, yeah, it's not really the fact that these guys were perfect, because that's not what saved you, fortunately. Because if being perfect is what saved you, then none of us could be saved. These are men of faith. These are men who trusted God. And it was their trust in God that sets them apart. That's what the writer of Hebrews is saying about Jephthah and the others. All right, let's talk to Richard from Seal Beach, California. Richard, welcome.
Yeah, Steve, I was watching the news this morning, and, you know, Abraham had many children, but the ones through Isaac and Jacob, they weren't called Jews till thousands of years later, after they returned from Babylon.
Right.
So exactly what race were they and the rest of his children? And they all lived in the continent of Asia. So I just wanted to hear your opinion on this, because I hate to agree with Whoopi, but I just want to hear your opinion. I'll listen to you on the radio. Thanks, Steve.
All right. Yeah, well, Whoopi was mistaken, I believe, but not entirely. When Whoopi Goldberg said that Jews are not a race, that's not entirely true, but it's partly true, because you can become a Jew if you're not racially a Jew. An Asian, a black person, a European person can become Jewish. You can become a proselyte and you become a Jew. But you're not part of the Jewish race. You're part of the Jewish people or, you know, religion and identity and so forth. So it's not strictly a Jewish, it's not strictly a racial thing. And that's even what we were talking about a moment ago with the previous caller, that just because someone has descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Paul was pointing out, not everyone was one of God's people in that. Was not one of them, not all of them are the Israel to whom the promises are made. But on the other hand, Whoopi's partly wrong, because the Jewish people, the word Jew comes from the word Judah. And the people of Judah were descended from the man Judah, who was a son of Jacob, who was a son of Isaac, who was a son of Abraham. So that, and Abraham, what race was he? He was a Hebrew. First time his race is mentioned, he's called Abraham the Hebrew in Genesis 14. Hebrews were apparently just a clan descended from, probably from the man Eber, Eberites or Hebrews. We know that Abraham lived in Babylon before he came to the Promised Land, so he was a Hebrew living in Babylon, a Gentile. And then God made promises to him related to his offspring. Now, his offspring weren't immediately a race any more than my children are a separate race. But Abram's offspring, who were descended from the 12 sons of Jacob, became a huge population when they were slaves in Egypt. And when God brought them out, they were primarily a racial group. I mean, I guess we have to decide what we call race. Whoopi Goldberg was saying, well, you know, they're not a race because they have white skin. Well, if a race is defined by skin color, then I guess they weren't a separate race. But I'm not sure why race would be determined by skin color. That certainly is not a definition of race, that someone has a different skin color. I would say that, you know, African, black Africans and black Australian Aboriginals are different races. They have black skin, but they're from very different lineages. Likewise, Jewish people, if they are descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they may look like the people in whatever lands they live in, because there are African Jews that look African. There are in Asia, there are Jews that look Asian. Certainly in Europe, most Jews look European. And that's partly because they've intermarried, obviously. They've intermarried with the local people. But being a Jew is not, as far as God is concerned, is not primarily a racial thing. Paul said in Romans chapter 2, in verse 28 and 29, he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward and of the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. And that circumcision is that which is of the heart and of the spirit. So God doesn't care about races. God doesn't prefer one race over another. Even in the Old Testament, when the Jews were a race and a nation that belonged to God, still people who were of that race could still be, the earth could open up and swallow them if God was angry at them. I mean, God didn't favor anyone just because they had the right ancestors. God favors people because of what's in their heart. That's what Paul said. It's not an outward thing to be Jewish. It's the inward thing. It's the circumcision of the heart. But there is a racial component, obviously. Jews, at least most Jews, believe that they are descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that is a racial kind of description. All right, Robert from New Haven, Connecticut, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Okay. My question is about Moses, when they said that God laid in wait for him and his wife did a circumcision and his son threw it to him. What was that about?
That's in Exodus chapter 4, where Moses was on his way to Egypt from Midian to fulfill the commission that God gave him to go confront Pharaoh and tell him to let the Israelites go. And Moses himself had neglected to obey God in a very important matter. As an Israelite, Moses was under commands that were given to all the children of Abraham to circumcise their sons on the eighth day of their life. And Moses had had a son in Midian with a Midian woman, Midianite woman, and he had not circumcised the son. And now he and his wife and his son are on their way to Egypt to obey God and tell and to command Pharaoh to obey God, and yet there's an area of disobedience in Moses. Moses has not obeyed God. He hasn't circumcised his son. So it was a bit of dirty laundry in his life that needed to be cleaned up before he could go and confront anyone else. I mean, a person who's going to tell other people to obey God had better be doing it themselves. And so something happened at the encampment. God, it says, tried to kill him. Now, if God really wanted to kill him, it would be no problem. He could easily have just taken his breath away and he'd die. But he was apparently doing something that endangered Moses' life. Many scholars assume that this is probably a reference to some sickness. God brought some great sickness on Moses that threatened to kill him. It's possible that God appeared in a human form, like when he wrestled with Jacob and was wrestling with Moses. We don't know. We don't know what that looked like. But his wife knew what that was about, and she circumcised the son. And by doing so, she averted the disaster. So this, you know, the problem is that Moses had not circumcised his son, and yet he's on a mission for God, and yet he's not obedient to God in this area. So on this occasion, with his wife circumcising the son, this you know, set that right, and God ceased to threaten Moses so he could continue.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. Janice from Seattle, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you very much. You're so articulate. I have a question on the Lord's Supper. You're there, right?
All right. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. What are your thoughts on opening up the communion table to all? Is it not dishonored when a non-believer partakes of it? It is a sacrament. I don't know.
Well, different churches have different policies. I know of groups that have what they call closed communion, which means that they don't let anybody take communion with them unless they are actually a member of their church, and this is because I assume they either believe that their church is the only church of true Christians, which is a rather cultic attitude, or maybe they don't think that way, but they figure we don't know this person. If they're not part of our church, we don't know if they're a Christian at all. They might be, but we can't vouch for it, so we're not going to serve them communion. Now, this, I think, is a mistake, because, of course, there are Christians in many denominations, and they do travel around and visit churches and so forth, and I mean, when they're on vacation somewhere else, they often will go to church in that location, or they'll visit friends and they'll go to their church with their friends. I mean, there's a lot of people go to churches who are true Christians who belong to different churches than the one they happen to be in. And if communion is being served, that's for all Christians. Of course, the minister of a church doesn't know if this stranger in his congregation who's just visiting is a real Christian or not, but that's not on him. That's on the person. I mean, most churches I know, when they serve communion, well, I don't know about most, but a lot of churches I know have made an announcement before they serve communion. They say, listen, this is for believers. If you're not a follower of Christ, you know, this is not really something that you have a part in. So you can just pass the elements by. And then they just trust the individual to take it or not. Now, if a non-Christian would take communion, I don't think that any harm is going to fall upon the church for that, because, you know, leaders of the church, they don't know who everybody is. So I believe that when communion is served, it should be served to everybody who professes to be a Christian. And then if it's not appropriate for someone to take it and they take it anyway, then I would say that's on them, not on the church. Hey, I'm out of time for the program. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, to see how to support us if you want to. That's thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.